but only recently pursued. Management later claimed that they had never known Stewart's desires. While every organization shoulders responsibility for people development and always benefits from understanding the career aspirations of its people, individual employees who allow themselves to feel victimized by a faulty process will seldom move forward an inch. For such individuals, getting stuck below the line when it comes to their personal development invariably results in missed opportunities for growth, progress, and career advancement. Even in organizations that manage people development poorly, talented and accountable people can still grow, develop, and win promotions if they assume personal accountability for their own progress. Without question, we agree that joint accountability for people development should exist between employees and their organizations. But we also believe that individuals at all levels of an organization should take charge of their own development. By functioning above the line, they will actively look for what more they can do to create their own opportunities for growth. They will pursue classes and training that will prepare them for advancement or increased effectiveness in their current jobs, find an appropriate mentor to advise them on a longer-term career path, continually seek feedback on their performance to measure their overall progress, and constantly ask themselves what else they can do to get the results they want for their careers. Looking at the bigger picture, they may also work to make sure the organization installs the right systems so the company can improve its ability to develop people. If that sort of attitude grows from the grassroots, it becomes so pervasive that it helps the entire organization rise above the line and own the responsibility to overcome any lethargy or inertia that impedes its investment in developing its most important asset. Issue 3, Empowerment. The concept of employee empowerment has received a lot of attention in recent years. Although much has been written and spoken on the subject, we constantly hear people throughout organizations blame poor results on a lack of empowerment. For example, two of the questions we hear senior management ask most frequently are, why are the directors not directing, and why don't they make decisions, own their areas, and get results? On the other hand, we often hear directors, managers, and employees question why senior management does not listen to their input, trust them to make decisions, and empower them to get results. They talk about having the responsibility to accomplish certain goals, but not having the necessary authority to get there. At the center of the debate over empowerment lies a great deal of continuing confusion. Just exactly what does it mean to be empowered, asked one CEO. I am so tired of hearing people say that they are not empowered. What more do they want? Everybody wants it, no one seems to know what it means, and nobody feels like they have it. If they don't feel they have what they need to get the job done, then why don't they go out and make it happen? If you have to wait for someone to empower you, then how in the world can you ever be empowered? Many contemporary managers and leaders echo this frustration. On the other hand, employees resent what they perceive as management's lofty and dismissive attitude and feel that management should realize that it often withholds from them the authority to direct resources, which, at the root, prevents people from becoming empowered. The confusion mounts as organizations debate whether empowerment requires an invitation or accrues through initiative. While the argument rages, organizations remain stuck below the line. Employees allow themselves to feel like victims of managers. Management behaves accordingly, and results get held hostage by indecision and inaction. The director of a mid-size high-tech company, whom we'll call Mark, found himself in charge of the development of a key new product. Mark got the job because management prized his ability to make things happen, and that's exactly what the development of this new product demanded. Most people in the company saw this move as an incredible career opportunity for Mark, and everyone assumed that Mark would soon become vice president. However, as Mark launched into the task, one that required a great deal of functional cooperation, he became frustrated with his inability to move ahead as quickly as he had hoped. Over a short period of time, his reputation among teammates suffered as others began to perceive him as a person who demanded that people do things his way. In Mark's mind, empowerment meant doing whatever he felt needed to be done, no matter what. He turned into a dictator. Since the organization had given Mark more authority, resources, and autonomy than it had to any other project team leader in its history, Mark felt entitled to say, "If you don't do this by Friday, I will not be responsible for the result." but the empowered dictator let himself off the hook. In essence, Mark relieved himself of accountability whenever he assigned it to someone else. With this attitude, he held the company hostage to his own limited definition of empowerment. Ultimately, Mark left the organization in frustration, and the product he left behind came onto the market 2 years late. In our way of thinking, empowered to get results and accountable for results are two sides of the same coin. But confusion over the meaning of empowerment sometimes blocks the path to getting above the line. Empowerment has come to be seen as something that someone does to you. We see accountability as something you do to yourself. Why not simply drop empowerment from your vocabulary and replace it with, what else can I do to get the result? Yes, management should own the responsibility for empowering people throughout the organization. But at some point, everyone must realize that ultimately, you must empower yourself. Rather than focusing on what someone else should do for you, focus more on what you must do yourself. Rather than shouting, "Empower me," just ask yourself the question, "What else can I do to achieve the result?" And then take the steps to see it, own it, solve it, and do it. These steps, if replicated throughout the organization, will yield tremendous benefits in terms of improved results, and in the end, they will deliver to the company an empowered organization and workplace. Like happiness, empowerment is more of an outcome than it is an activity. It stems from accountable people. You can either get lost in the debate over what it means, or you can take accountability and act to make it happen. Issue 4, misalignment. Every organization needs a clear focus, a strategy that drives its actions in the marketplace. However, in virtually every company with which we've worked over the past 2 decades, we have found that different people, and particularly the senior staff, hold quite different views of the organization's overall direction, a misalignment of visions that can permeate every level of the company. Many organizations spend countless hours discussing such strategic questions as, what business are we in and where are we going, without forging a clear answer. Without answering such questions, key people and their teams march to the tunes of their own favorite drummers, unaligned on a playing field where ultimate success hinges on everyone marching in the same direction. As a result, teams work tentatively and never forge the full-fledged ownership necessary to bring projects to successful conclusions. Eventually, as more and more projects fail, misalignment flourishes and thrusts a great many people below the line. The Mid-Atlantic area of Johnson Controls suffered such misalignment before the company decided to implement the Oz principle. Although each function and department had been focusing on meeting its own objectives, that wasn't achieving overall business results. When the company put together proposals and bid on major climate control projects for large buildings, the same problems kept cropping up. Each department and function prepared its piece of the proposal. They combined them all together and submitted them promptly. But the company kept losing out to competitors. According to area manager Alan Martin, we were so process-oriented that we fell into a sort of default mode, just doing the same thing over and over. But the different parts of the organization did not want to change. Market share declined, growth stagnated, morale plunged, and customers grew more and more dissatisfied with the company's performance. As Martin recalled, people in the different departments were so concerned about covering their tails and documenting the things they had done to prove their value that it really impeded the organization's ability to be innovative and strategic, and no one was working together to build the business. That's when the Oz principle came aboard. After several months spent building greater accountability around the three strategic thrusts of the organization, grow 15%, become number one in the market, and change the business's value proposition, everything started to improve. 15, 1, and change became the mantra of every department in the organization. Sales, operations, installation, and services all began working together in harmony. People began rethinking their roles and responsibilities. They started communicating with each other, and they got aligned, Martin recounted. Once everyone had been through the training, they began saying things like, "Okay, we need to do something different." A jumbled box of puzzle pieces now fit together beautifully as people became more operationally flexible and began building greater trust between departments. The emphasis changed from the tired old excuses and finger-pointing to, "What else can we do to get the results we want?" We had to actualize everything that we'd gone through in the Oz training, Martin told us in a recent interview. First, we had to see it, see what the issues were, what was impeding our ability to do it. We had to look at our situation from each of the Oz steps, see it, own it, solve it, do it. That's when the accountability plan started to take hold. Everyone seemed to recognize that this was the only way we were going to turn things around, by getting our business above the line together. In the 3 years after Johnson Controls implemented the Oz training, Alan Martin's Mid-Atlantic area sales more than doubled, profitability tripled, customer satisfaction soared, and employee turnover dropped to its lowest level in years. Now the business is chanting 25-1 and change. While everyone benefits from tightly focused direction and concerted effort in pursuit of a common goal, creating alignment should not fall solely on the shoulders of the top brass. These challenges extend to every facet of an operation. The directors and managers beneath the senior management team can usually see the effects of misalignment quite clearly. They often complain that they seem to be working at odds with their peers throughout the organization, and they cite numerous examples of mixed messages flowing from their superiors about the direction they should pursue in a given situation. The confusion caused by misalignment then trickles all the way down to the mailroom. Such confusion always signals a below-the-line attitude. As role models, misaligned managers give license to everyone beneath them to do the same. By allowing confusion to dictate company direction, they breed lack of respect for senior company leadership, not to mention a need for people to be told what to do every step of the way. Eventually, they create victims. Post-evaluations of bankruptcies almost always point to an alignment problem at the top that eventually infested every part of the organization. A close friend of ours worked for International Harvester before it went bankrupt. He still remembers how the misalignment among the company's senior team grew in the years before the bankruptcy from a seed of half-hearted support and whispered criticism of corporate policies into a towering oak of dissatisfaction that eventually gridlocked the entire organization, forcing it into Chapter 11. Even when management creates alignment, many team members fail to communicate the message to their people, somehow assuming that team members will intuitively understand and buy into important decisions they have made. Thus, even when alignment does exist, managers sometimes wait to see if effective and consistent implementation of the desired direction will occur. Everyone must accept accountability for creating and maintaining alignment within their organization by first acknowledging that failing to do so will keep their organizations below the line, creating inefficiencies, low morale, stress, finger-pointing, and confusion. To get above the line, you should consider the ramifications of every decision and then involve everyone affected in a discussion before finalizing the decision. By welcoming a diversity of opinions, suggestions, and perspectives, by utilizing an open decision-making process to determine your course of action, by communicating the aligned message clearly to the rest of the organization, by actively promoting the decision as a collective effort, and by coaching away any misalignments, you can assure more coherent and cohesive action throughout your organization. Issue 5, Entitlement. Over time, and quite naturally, some people become accustomed to an organization's systems of rewards, benefits, and traditions. From the yearly bonus to periodic celebrations of success, people tend to expect certain events to continue, an expectation that can transform events from meaningful occasions to rights or entitlements the people feel they deserve no matter what. As companies seek to become more competitive by changing the way they do business, and as they strive to get closer to their customers, become more efficient, more productive, and more profitable, they find that certain cultural entitlements can do more harm than good. The right to an annual bonus, a routine annual increase in compensation, an 8-to-5 workday, regular recognition events, lifetime job security regardless of performance, and other long-established traditions and practices may have served their purposes in the past, but they may undermine the future if people expect them to continue regardless of their level of performance or ability to get results. In time, every organization reaches a point where it must reconsider its entitlements. Unfortunately, when they do so, employees tend to drop below the line, feeling victimized by the company to such an extent that morale evaporates and people begin questioning their very association with the organization. Not long ago, we observed a relatively new, fast-growing company as it encountered predictable competitive pressures that slowed its growth rate and weakened its profit picture. In its early years, the company, let's call it Newtek Incorporated, had soared. Its product had grabbed the number one position in the market, and its profit margins outshone everyone else's in the industry. For employees, Newtek seemed like a paradise. It operated the best equipment, ran the best computers, one on each desk, offered the best benefits, threw the best parties, and generally promoted a first-class image. When executives traveled, they stayed in luxury hotels and dined at the most exclusive restaurants. Throughout the industry, stories of the good life at Newtek prompted the best and the brightest in the industry to seek jobs there. However, when a tough new competitive environment hit Newtek and the company began to implement far-reaching changes that reversed much of what people had come to expect as entitlements, the organization quickly fell below the line. Each time management questioned or abandoned an entitlement, new victims emerged, each disgruntled that management had taken away something they deserved. No one had ever bothered linking benefits to performance when performance came so easily, so the new emphasis on performance shocked the culture to its roots. Eventually, the people at Newtek faced up to the reality that they did not deserve anything they could not produce. But not until after a massive layoff and a precipitous decline in market share forced them to do so. Every day in the business press, you can find an example of a company once known for its lifetime employment policies. An Eastman Kodak, IBM, or AT&T that has resorted to laying off people because the company's performance has fallen. To employees conditioned to think of their jobs as a lifelong guaranteed right, the idea that their jobs depend on their company's ability to fund them does not come easily. To help people make that shift, more and more companies are attempting to build employee ownership into their cultures. If employees own their circumstances, they will more readily work to solve problems and guarantee their own continued employment. In today's unforgiving environment, companies must learn how to manage organizational processes in a way that does not disconnect individual accountability from organizational results. They must understand that almost everything they give to employees at any level, with the exception of fundamental values such as fairness, honesty, and respect, flows from individual and organizational performance. Individual employees can avoid the feelings of victimization that attend the loss of entitlements by viewing all the practices, rewards, and benefits the organization offers as privileges that come by virtue of excellent performance, rather than rights that automatically begin accruing the day you're hired. By striving to ensure that your performance will earn you the rewards you want, and by working to make your organization as productive as possible to create such rewards, you will move yourself above the line. To paraphrase the Smith Barney commercial, I get my rewards the old-fashioned way, I earn them. Issue 6. Work and personal life imbalance. Our work in hundreds of organizations convinced us that most every company struggles with conflicting priorities. These conflicts include focusing on quantity while at the same time delivering a high degree of quality, hitting short-term target numbers and at the same time thinking long-term strategy, and sacrificing all your time and energy to succeed in business while spending the time you need to nurture your family relationships. We think success in the future will come to those who learn to master such conflicting priorities. To do so, people must view these apparent conflicts not as mixed messages, but as challenges of balance, accomplishment, and growth. Perhaps the most difficult of them all is that of creating a balance between work and personal life. The World Health Organization recently called job stress a worldwide epidemic. Work-life balance has become a hot topic in most organizations, and the rising generation, those hitting the job market today, clearly prefers better balance to more salary. Still, most everyone deals with the threat of burning out in their job because of personal work-life imbalance. From the Monster.com and MSN Careers website, Bill Delano, founder of an internet service that provides confidential, individualized advice via email to those experiencing job stress, provides some suggestions, a few of which align perfectly with the Oz principle. See it. What exactly is stressing you out? Is it your job, your home life, your relationships? Without knowing the root of the problem, you cannot hope to resolve it. If you find it difficult to pinpoint the source of your stress, seek professional help from your employee assistance program or a mental health professional. Own it. Try not to personalize any criticism you receive. Look at negative comments as constructive help that allows you to improve your work. If, however, the criticism is verbally abusive, e.g., your boss yells at you or uses vulgar language, discuss this problem with your manager or human resources department. Solve it. Recognize the difference between elements at work and at home that you can control and ones you cannot. Make a list of these two categories. Starting today, promise yourself to stop stressing about uncontrollable aspects of your job. Delegate or share work whenever possible. Don't fall into the trap of thinking that you are the only person who can do the job right. Your coworkers and boss might start to buy into that concept as well. And do it. Take note of all the good work you do and give yourself credit for it. Set short-term goals, rewarding yourself when you achieve them. Although you do want to learn how to manage a stressful job, sometimes it makes more sense to leave it. How can you determine when it's time to throw in the towel? When you've tried all the appropriate channels and methods for resolving your situation to no avail, or the appropriate channels don't even exist. Your boss treats you in ways that you find intimidating, disrespectful, or demeaning. And you feel so bored on the job that you come home exhausted at the end of the day. If you cannot see an upwardly mobile career path that challenges you to grow professionally, you should probably look for a more interesting position. As more and more companies embark on programs of downsizing, delayering, and parallel pathing in an effort to enhance productivity and profitability, employees who survive the organizational reengineering find themselves under even more pressure to do more with less. In most cases, more with less equals stress. During our consulting engagement with scores of such organizations, we've heard a lot of talk about the tremendous stress that major changes can cause, with most of the concern centering on the dilemma of balancing a successful career with a fulfilling personal life. John Sculley, former CEO of Apple Computer, told USA Today, "A good night's sleep is a remnant of agrarian and industrial ages. The information age, with easy communication around the globe and constant access to changing data, is making a night's sleep a thing of the past. It's a 24-hour day, not an 8-to-5 day." USA Today reporter Kevin Maney went on to say, "A few executives share Sculley's wide-eyed approach. President Clinton often gets by on a couple of hours of sleep. David Johnson, CEO of Campbell Soup, works throughout a 24-hour day so he can keep track of worldwide operations." In the same article, Maney asks, "Is Sculley's routine the model for the new millennium executive, or is it just weird?" While John Sculley may be an extreme example, there is a trend toward longer hours and less free time. If your company has downsized or flattened itself to save resources, you may expect to work longer hours, extend your average work week, and find all too little time for family, friends, and recreation. Organizational life can disrupt your family and personal life so much that you can easily start feeling taken advantage of and betrayed by the company to which you have pledged your heart and soul. And increasingly in corporate America, organizations are expecting people to give more and more of their time to work, leaving less time for home and loved ones. Learning to balance the two will take just as much time and effort as solving any major business problem. One of our clients dealt head-on with a similar kind of problem. The company's senior management team understood the added pressures their employees faced as they worked to bring several new products to market. But rather than just wait for the situation to change, they decided to do something about it. Aware that their people were sacrificing the quality of their personal lives for the company, the management team invited candid feedback so they could understand exactly how people felt about the situation. Then the management team met and talked at length about the increased pressure on employees. After some tough deliberation, they agreed to make balancing personal and professional life one of the 6 corporate beliefs that would guide their organizational culture. As a result, any employee could say no to a late-night meeting without fear of retribution. If someone seemed to feel that saying no would evidence disloyalty, a manager would quickly send that person home with a pat on the back. In effect, the company promised to support its people if they assumed their own accountability for what they chose to do and not to do. We admired their handling of the issue. Full of young, aspiring professional people who want to make a difference and succeed, the company has turned in incredible growth and profits, all the while nurturing a culture imbued with accountability for both corporate and personal goals. Resource constraints will continue to rule business life. Few organizations can escape the reality of a world where you must do more with less. To avoid falling below the line on this issue, management must acknowledge the personal price it asks its employees to pay and then work to find ways to help them correct any imbalance. By the same token, employees must get above the line and own their own circumstances. The storm of change will not abate. The average work week will grow longer. More will be required of everyone. Understanding this reality will help you to adjust to it, making the personal and professional trade-offs that work best for you. Issue 7, Poor Performance. Throughout this book, we have talked about the pivotal role feedback plays in creating high levels of accountability within an organization. Yet it continually amazes us that few organizations establish an environment that fosters the free flow of feedback. In such cases, obviously you cannot expect to confront poor performance skillfully or coach performance effectively. By failing to confront poor performance, organizations unwittingly foster feelings of victimization among people who do perform poorly but don't know it and thus can't affect improvements, as well as among people who must pick up the slack because of poor performance of others. Poor performance leads to poor results, and poor results keep entire organizations below the line. When we urge executives, managers, and supervisors to confront this problem, they tend to cite several reasons for failing to deal with performance issues. The specter of lawsuits by poor performers who claim wrongful dismissal, a reluctance to hurt people's feelings, the difficulty of establishing a fair but effective review process, a tendency to shy away from time-consuming documentation, and a general fear of the risk involved in confronting poor performance. Others cite loyalty to coworkers as a transcendent cultural code, a twisted application of the golden rule, be nice to them and others will be nice to you. While still others cite a lack of training on how to handle such situations, especially when they themselves hate confrontation. A few organizations even claim that they enjoy sufficient resources to carry non-performers whose efforts neither hurt nor help much, but even those companies end up paying a price eventually. Everyone has heard about a person who suffered great trauma when fired from one job, but after grueling months of searching found another even more suitable job. One such case occurred with a young MBA, whom we'll call Ted. Ted was very aggressive and had set his eyes at a marketing management position that he hoped to attain in relatively short order. He accepted any and every project with great enthusiasm and worked nights and weekends to do everything better and faster than it had ever been done before. To get things done quickly, Ted applied a great deal of pressure to coworkers and soon developed an abrasive style that seemed to get results. In particular, he insulated his own project teams from the demands and needs of other parts of the organization to fulfill his own fast-track objectives. Ted's projects received a great deal of praise within the company as they came in on time and under budget, and Ted's apparent ability to get results won him distinction as the best marketing project leader in the company's history. However, in the midst of all this glory, Ted's boss, along with several other senior managers, grew deeply concerned about Ted's actual performance. The way he ran roughshod over people and destroyed relationships would, management felt, eventually undermine his effectiveness. But rather than confront Ted over these issues, they decided to let Ted learn his lesson the hard way. Besides, rocking the boat might undermine the results he was turning in. Shunning the uncomfortable prospect of confronting Ted over his style and coaching him beyond it, they let him run loose, hoping he'd end up learning the error of his ways all on his own. Over time, however, Ted's behavior grew worse, not better, as he continued to burn bridges and force outcomes. Eventually, the head of the department began privately approaching Ted's boss, demanding that she do something about Ted's abrasiveness. When Ted's boss did finally sit Ted down to offer him specific feedback on the problem, Ted blew up. "I thought results were the only things that mattered around here." Now he felt betrayed and confused. "Why didn't you say something earlier?" he demanded. As it turned out, the feedback came too late, as Ted concluded that he could never be happy in this organization. He left, but to his credit, he took a greater awareness of himself to his next job, where, after a few short years, he forged a reputation not only as a guy who gets results, but as one who gets results as a respectful team player. Ted eventually won, but his original organization paid a price by losing their investment in all the learning and experience they had given Ted. Had they dealt with performance issues in a proper and timely way, they would have saved themselves more than just money. We strongly believe management must learn how to confront poor performance in a precise, constructive, and supportive way. By dealing head-on with this universal issue, you can move more surely above the line, improving results while at the same time making people happier. Very simply, you must learn to tackle poor performance when you see it and accept constructive feedback when you receive it, and you must develop a culture that encourages this behavior in others. If you pretend the issue doesn't exist or wait to see if it will solve itself, stop right now. Make confronting performance a daily habit. Don't let the problems build and get handed down from one generation of managers to the next. Issue 8, Senior Management Development. Who will tell the emperor that he has no clothes? Many of the CEOs and senior managers we know lament the loneliness of leadership, and most would agree that they receive too little feedback on their effectiveness, style, or overall impact on their organizations. However, if a senior manager thinks he or she cannot affect the flow of feedback, that opinion reflects a true below-the-line attitude. We have heard leaders in all types of organizations say, "No matter how much I ask my people for feedback, I just cannot get them to muster up the courage to give it to me straight." Given the fact that employees also tend to function below the line on this issue, believing that coaching senior management can spell career suicide, senior managers would do well to take the first step by opening themselves up to such coaching. If they don't learn to do so in these perilous times, they stand to lose everything they have worked so hard to achieve. It's happening to Steven Jobs for the second time. Several years ago, the Wall Street Journal reported his computer company, Next Incorporated, stopped making computers. In March of 1993, his president and his chief financial officer quit. Then, several big computer makers, some of which he had hoped would use his software, formed a software alliance that excluded Next. Just as happened at Apple Computer, the company he founded and eventually lost to John Sculley, Steven Jobs' unwillingness to receive feedback may have destroyed any opportunity for him to attain stardom once again. His insistence on complete control over a project with IBM, for example, doomed a 1989 agreement that would have lent Big Blue's backing to Nexus software. And he lost valuable time last year when he ignored advisors' repeated warnings that Next couldn't compete in hardware and should become a software company. The result of Steven Jobs' inability to welcome coaching amounts to a steep fall from a very lofty perch. According to the same article, his Next workstation seems destined to become a high-tech museum relic. He himself is fighting to show he still matters in the computer industry. According to Richard Schaefer, editor of Computer Letter, people have stopped paying attention to him. It's sad. But that wasn't the end of the story. Alan Deutschman sets the record straight in his book, The Second Coming of Steven Jobs. 2 years after his premature postmortem in the Wall Street Journal, Steven Jobs rose triumphant, vindicated, and far richer than before. He had learned how to take the criticism and grow from it. His stunning redemption came from an unexpected source. It turned out that he owned another company, Pixar, which struggled quietly for a decade. In November 1995, Pixar released the first full-length computer-animated feature film, Toy Story. His stake in the company was valued at over $1 billion. A year later, he returned to Apple. Then, in the summer of 1997, he took the title of interim chief executive officer and became the company's unexpected savior. He propelled Apple's stock price from $13 a share to $118 a share. Steven Jobs' experience should convince anyone of the value of candid feedback for everyone, especially those at the top. Both employees and senior management must accept the fact that feedback creates accountability. Every action by a member of senior management affects the organization, and being human, every senior manager possesses both strengths and weaknesses. No company can grow unless the senior managers grow, and the CEO is not immune. He or she must also grow. If they do not, either the organization will falter or it will outgrow them. The best senior managers not only search for ways they can improve their performance, they encourage those around them to tell them the truth, no matter how painful. Most leaders really do want feedback from their people. Consider a case in point: Ginger Graham, then president and CEO of Advanced Cardiovascular Systems, who began her tenure as president of the company by soliciting candid feedback from all levels of the organization on how both she and the company could grow in the future. People who would have otherwise ducked the danger inherent in offering a new CEO honest feedback eagerly accepted the risk. Graham went out of her way to follow up on all feedback, letting people know how much she valued it and describing exactly how she was going to use it to improve herself and ACS. And she did. In fact, in an article Ginger wrote in the Harvard Business Review entitled, "If You Want Honesty, Break Some of the Rules," she described the feedback process we helped her take her team through. One by one, each member of the team would sit on a tall stool and receive both appreciative and constructive feedback on their performance. The person in the hot seat could only listen. As Ginger recounts, the stool exercise sounded cruel, but it is just the opposite. It is probably the most powerful tool for building mutual accountability and honest communication I've ever seen. And when I sat on it, I found out how much my managers cared about me and wanted me to succeed. Ginger gets feedback because she holds herself accountable to ask for it and to provide it. We urge CEOs to follow Ginger's lead and assume personal accountability for obtaining feedback by making it widely known that they want it and value it. Openly thanking those who give them tough feedback will cause others to do likewise. For their part, employees must overcome the fear of risk and tell inquiring senior managers what they really need to hear. Issue 9. Cross-functional strife. Marketing versus manufacturing. Manufacturing versus research and development. R&D versus sales. And sales versus the world. Sound familiar? We see it everywhere we go. Cross-functional strife. In fact, these battles have become something of a tradition in organizational life, even though they represent one of the most short-sighted, below-the-line occurrences in business today. Why can't corporate functions rise above the line and finally recognize, to misquote Pogo, that we have met the enemy and the enemy is not us? One organization we worked with came to a virtual standstill as the research and development department and the marketing department waged a feud that would have made the Hatfields and the McCoys look like kids quarreling in a sandbox. Each of the combatants consistently worked as if the other were its nemesis. The vice presidents literally hated each other and openly discussed their disdain for one another's style and competence with their respective management teams. As a result, this company, which once led its industry in product innovation, failed to turn out any breakthrough products for an entire year. Furthermore, the products that did make it to market came in way over budget and far behind schedule. We could clearly see that the future of the entire organization depended on the two departments getting above the line and bringing the blame game to a screeching halt. It took a year, but vigorous application of the Oz principle resulted, after more than a little stress and strain, in a renewed sense of cooperation and camaraderie. "We were nuts," one vice president told us later. "We were both in the same boat, but we were doing our level best to sink each other. We still get into tussles over priorities, but now we're at least rowing in the same direction." This scenario repeats itself every minute of every working day in thousands of organizations. However, you can eliminate the cross-functional strife more easily than you think. All it takes is a constant reminder that your organization's real enemy is not Joe or Sally down the hall, but your mistaken assumption that Joe or Sally is not on your team. Above-the-line leadership requires people and functions across the organization to acknowledge the reality that the market will not forgive the damage caused by cross-functional strife. People and functions must give each other the benefit of the doubt and the feedback essential to make appropriate and necessary performance improvements. They must step out of their functional silos and create a correlated effort between departments based on a productive give-and-take attitude that can drive a concerted focus on producing the greatest good for the company. As Pogo might have put it, "We have met the enemy, and the enemy is our own divisiveness." Remember Alaris Medical Systems and their incredible turnaround? It was carrying a backlog of 9,000 instruments with 5,000 spare parts on order and disposable fill rates below 85%, all in the face of declining revenues. Key to turning around their poor performance, eliminating back orders, achieving dramatically improved product quality, and maintaining a 24-hour delivery rate of 99.8% were a series of cross-functional feedback sessions held between operations, sales, customer care, quality, and service, where individuals confronted the group with hard facts that many did not want to hear. These sessions helped everyone to see it and build greater cooperation. Sally Grigoriev, a vice president with Alaris, said, "These sessions were the equivalent of a walk a mile in my shoes in both directions. The prior adversarial relationship between operations and customer care disappeared." Sally describes, "Now when there is an issue, people pick up the phone. Before, people didn't pick up the phone because they did not know each other. Since that meeting, we've had customer care down to tour the plant, something they had never done before. Now they understand our processes, have a feel for how things work, and have put faces with names." The organization began measuring order fulfillment on a daily basis, a measurement the entire organization received daily by email. This measurement showed performance during the last 24 hours. People saw it. In the past, hundreds of late orders on a daily basis came to no one's attention. Since beginning the candid and open cross-functional meetings, just one late order will send people scurrying to coordinate resolution of the problem between all the different functions. On this point, Sally said, "It's just the most amazing transformation you have ever seen." When people hurdle the natural barriers of functional expertise and preferences and align themselves for the common good, powerful forces go to work, forces that can affect performance in dramatic ways. Getting above the line to capture these advantages should preoccupy every leader and every team. Issue 10, Programitis. A disease has spread throughout corporate America, a disease we call programitis. Its symptoms include every new program or fad that comes down the road. A complete list of all the management fads that have come down the road in the last 20 years would look like the Manhattan telephone directory. A short list of the most popular ones might include strategic planning, total quality management, just-in-time manufacturing, breakthrough innovation, total customer satisfaction, learning organizations, core competencies, business reengineering, zero-based budgeting, flat organization, self-management, team-driven leadership, humble leadership, and creative destruction. In a classic Sloan Management Review article entitled "Consulting Has the Solution Become Part of the Problem," authors Shapiro, Eccles, and Soski make this observation. Fad surfing, riding the crest of the newest panacea and then paddling out just in time to ride the crest of the next one, has become big business over the past 20 years. Each of these concepts comes with a prepackaged set of tools, many of which existed previously and which have been repackaged and marketed as the answer to competitiveness. Over the years, we've watched many fads come and go, leaving little more than a ripple in their wake. AT&T, for example, laid off 1,000 out of 6,600 employees at a factory that won the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award. The factory, which makes transmission systems equipment, including hardware used by phone and cable TV companies, blamed the layoffs on slow sales and technological advances. The Wallace Company, another winner of the same award, filed for Chapter 11 just 2 years later. No matter how you look at this situation, it's obvious that total quality management alone does not prevent 1,000 people from losing their jobs. Check a factory sales decline or deal with the human side of technological advancement. Back when American companies were emulating the Japanese, the Wall Street Journal reported that some American manufacturers are discarding billions of dollars of investment they made in the 1980s to adopt Japanese manufacturing ideas. They haven't decided that the Japanese systems don't work. Rather, they realize that some of those systems, however useful in lifting productivity in Japan, haven't achieved much in their own plants. So if the Japanese fad did not produce lasting value for most American manufacturers, where do we turn next? The journal article continues, "Federal Mogul Corporation, deciding that its automation had gone too far, has removed much of the fancy equipment at an auto parts plant. And General Motors Corporation is now relying more heavily on people power. Whirlpool Corporation has soured on Japanese-style quality circles as a means of tapping employees' ideas. and General Electric and Corning Incorporated have turned to other ways of tapping employee ideas. Losing favor at some companies is the Japanese just-in-time system of minimizing inventory by having suppliers deliver parts only as needed. In the field of computer technology, where changes come at lightning speed, downsizing has become the latest fad. According to William Zachman, the columnist and industry watcher, credited with coining the term downsizing in an earlier Wall Street Journal article, people have gone overboard on the concept. It's like people, upon first hearing about electricity, suck their finger in the light socket to check it out. It's become a mindless fad. Even companies with a lot of experience in managing technology have made silly mistakes by pursuing downsizing and right-sizing programs that produce more confusion than results. The problem, as we see it, is that any number of management philosophies and techniques can and do produce results. But too many organizations look for the wizard's magic in the latest one, when, in fact, results will only come through a unified sense of accountability for results throughout the organization. We feel strongly that organizations must find a cure for programitis, part of which involves paying attention to the basic fact that most anything will work if you get above the line and use your head. Act with courage. Maintain a stout heart. And keep your eye on the main objective, whether you want to get back to Kansas, bring products to market faster, or fulfill the true needs of customers. The benefits will more than please you. Reaping benefits above the line. As we conclude this journey, we'd like to show some final examples of clients that have benefited greatly from getting above the line and staying there. Precor, one of the largest fitness manufacturers in the United States, has built a global reputation for innovation and excellence in fitness equipment quality and customer service. Despite a clear history of entrepreneurial success, they never felt satisfied merely staying in place. Rather, they strove constantly to step up to the next level and achieve even greater results by transforming their entire culture into one of accountability and focusing even more tightly on innovation, results, and product development. In Precor's 2003 all-employee kickoff, President Paul J. Burns stated, "The world's a mess. The economy is slow and the weather is bad. The company is in Seattle. We're simply not going to accept any of these old excuses anymore." After 15 months of focused, concerted effort to transform their culture, imbue accountability in everyone, and improve business operations, Precor recorded their best year ever, increasing revenues by 13% and profitability by 66%, while substantially increasing their service measures. These performance improvements did not come because the company has slumped. To the contrary, the improvements came because a highly effective organization knew that it could always accomplish more by rigorously applying the Oz principle. Indiana-based Eli Lilly and Company struggled with public perception that they were not supporting minority-owned business in their home state. For years, company officials would say, "We try to get minority business. We've sent out proposals. We've waited here with the paperwork and have been willing and would be pleased to work with anyone who came in and took the job." Then, dedicating itself to getting above the line on this issue, the company decided to stop waiting for something to happen and, instead, go out and make it happen. Members of Lilly's Capital Project Engineering Group sat down with a longtime supplier, Jacobs Engineering, to plan how they could actually help create a minority-owned business. They concluded that a startup business could quickly grow into a full-time firm that would not only work for Lilly, but for other companies as well. The CEO of Jacobs Engineering gave Lilly's capital projects engineers total support, stating that they would provide work process and procedures and help line up needed investors in Indianapolis to start this firm from scratch. For its part, Lilly committed that it would pay the new firm within 15 days instead of the 35 days afforded to other vendors. In a short period of time, they lined up the needed investors to start a small minority-owned engineering firm. During the first year, this firm billed over $3.5 million worth of engineering service fees in the Indianapolis area. Again, we see a high-performing organization benefit from greater accountability by driving beyond the expected to deliver unexpected results. Operating above the line opens doors that cause things to happen, things that would never, ever happen below the line. One last example comes from AmerisourceBergen, a wholesale pharmaceutical and healthcare supply and service company. Not long ago, the company faced a situation not uncommon in the business world, the loss of a significant national account. People in the organization found themselves wrestling with the dilemma that every reader of this book encounters most every day in one form or another. Do you fall below the line and justify a setback by ignoring, denying, blaming, and finger-pointing? Or do you go above the line, acknowledging the reality, and find a way to get the result in spite of the setback? Rallying the company with a sense of ownership and accountability, AmerisourceBergen's management team helped to inspire a solvent mentality within the organization. People at every level, however remote from sales their job may have seemed, began asking what else they could do to ensure results. With that mindset, some people came up with ways to cut costs, while others found ways to increase revenue. Impressively, this organization set out to replace the business they knew they were going to lose before they actually lost it. With their focus on what else can we do, they added, in just the 3 months prior to the anticipated loss of business, 67 new accounts and replaced approximately 70% of the projected loss. Accountability begins with clearly defined results, people committed to operating above the line, and leaders who relentlessly reinforce that culture. While each of these three stories reflects a variety of results and circumstances, they all share one common moral. Accountable people working together can achieve almost anything. The Unending Journey. So we arrive at the end of the book. The lion has found his courage, the Tin Woodsman his heart, and the Scarecrow his brain, and Dorothy has awakened safely at home with Auntie M. And if we've accomplished our own mission in these pages, you're well on the road to accountability, applying the Oz principle to every aspect of your life and work. Remember, only when you assume full accountability for your thoughts, feelings, actions, and results can you direct your own destiny. Otherwise, someone or something else will. As a final note, just inside the cover of one of the many sequels to The Wizard of Oz, the publisher, Del Rey Books, printed the following message to readers. When we mention Oz to people who haven't grown up with the books, they nod, mention Judy Garland, and think they know all there is to know about Oz. How wrong they are. We echo that sentiment as we write the end of our own book. There's a lot to learn in Oz. Enjoy the lifelong journey. The beginning. We hope you've enjoyed The Oz Principle, an Oasis audio production under arrangement with Partners in Leadership Incorporated. Text copyright 2004 by Roger Connors, Tom Smith, and Craig Hickman. Production copyright 2010 by Oasis Audio, under arrangement with Partners in Leadership Incorporated.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.